Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, December 8th, welcome, welcome, welcome on Into the Program, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, where I have to announce we did not receive a Golden Globe nomination this year at Studio 2. Crushed
bummer.
Yet again, maybe
bummer.
Next year.
We will try again. One of these years, you never know.
I know.
So today on the show, we're going to be talking about the use of artificial intelligence in surveillance. We are living in a world right now where cameras are everywhere. I have two of these that I carry around in my purse every single day. And most of us, we have them in our pockets. We have them in our homes. But many of them also employ artificial intelligence. I mean, think about it. Your Ring camera can communicate with police. There's also facial recognition technology you use at the airport. And if you think about it, you also can get a ticket thanks to AI reading your license plate number if you go through a red light or you're speeding down or up Broad Street. And we become pretty used to it. But the questions we're going to talk about today is when this type of technology crosses the line and starts invading your privacy. And so we have a couple of experts who know all about the use of AI and surveillance. And so we'd love to hear from you as well. Would you trade privacy for a sense of safety? And does artificial intelligence and surveillance make you feel safer? The question, those are our questions of the day. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, leave your comments in the chat. There's so many questions around this.
So many questions and so many uses.
Yes.
And locally as well. You know, Temple announced pretty recently that they would integrate AI into their video surveillance technology. Mm-hmm. At one point, SEPTA was using AI surveillance technology to spot weapons on the system. They're no longer doing that, but it's been used in the past. So this is something that, like you said, it's happening all around us. Mm-hmm. It's private cameras. It's public cameras. It's here, there, and everywhere. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And speaking of SEPTA, let's get into our trio of local news stories. SEPTA services are running more or less as normal today for now.
Mm-hmm.
After seemingly coming to the brink of a strike over the weekend, representatives from SEPTA's largest union are back at the table with the transit agency trying to hammer out a labor deal. And a SEPTA spokesperson told the Inquirer that Governor Josh Shapiro helped to reignite these talks after it seemed the sides had reached an impasse. TWU Local 234 represents the folks who operate subways, buses, and trolleys in the city, among other workers. They have authorized a strike, and there was a moment where it looked like they were about to walk off the job and that the strike could start today. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it hasn't, but there's still no deal in place. Reportedly, both sides are close on salary. They both want a two-year deal, but there's some difference of opinion over pension benefits and healthcare costs.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a tough year for SEPTA.
Yeah.
We've been talking about SEPTA quite often.
Understatement of the year would be tough.
I mean, but fingers crossed that SEPTA and TWU Local 234 can work it out, because it is not easy, because anything that they agree to will have a ripple effect to the other unions attached to SEPTA. And, you know, SEPTA is already struggling when it comes to funding. They don't have a permanent source of funding. And every time we turn around, there's been these stopgap measures that kind of keeps the buses rolling, so to speak. But, you know, you can only imagine what a strike would do, the kind of chaos it would cause. We have tens of thousands of students that rely on SEPTA every day, hundreds of thousands of people that rely on SEPTA to get to and fro work. So we really need SEPTA to keep going. And every time there is a strike, you lose ridership. And when you lose ridership, then you have to talk about, do we need this many routes? And if we need less routes, do we need this many people? So
the fabled death spiral.
There's a ripple effect there. Yeah. So hopefully they can work it out.
And if you haven't been following this story, these particular workers, this particular union works in the city of Philadelphia mostly. So this strike, if it happens, would majority affect services within the city of Philadelphia, not regional rail. Of course, regional rail dealing with its own problems, which we've talked about on prior shows, and we'll probably talk about again on another day. Story number two, Cherry.
Yeah, the city of Wilmington down in Delaware is giving teachers and school staff support in purchasing a home in that city. Wilmington is offering up to $15,000 in the form of a one-time forgivable loan that will go toward the down payment of a purchase of a home in Wilmington. And according to the city, to the story that we found on Delaware Online, the loan would be forgivable as long as the person is a first-time home buyer, confirms that they worked full-time in one of the city's public or charter schools for 5 years, and lives in the home for 10 years. There's also some other requirements as well, but this loan is for teachers and administrators, but also bus drivers, custodians, lunch staff, and others who work in the school. And this type of program is commonly used to recruit and retain staff at educational institutions. The University of Delaware did something like this. UPenn has done something like this. Folks have offered, you know, cheaper rent to teachers in certain parts of Philadelphia as well. So it's kind of cool, like a little perk for teachers who work really, really hard and sometimes don't get paid what, you know, the work is valued.
Yeah. Two birds, one stone, right? Yeah. We can't, you know, attract teachers. Also, housing's unaffordable. So let's try to meet in the middle here with some policy. Obviously, it's a small thing, but it's the idea that caught our attention and captured our imagination. And, you know, like you said, higher education institutions have been doing this for a while. Penn, as you mentioned, has done a lot of stuff to try to recruit staff, to keep staff local. They even they've helped to fund their own elementary school in the neighborhood.
That
is part of staff recruitment. I mean, that's explicitly part of the deal there. So not a new idea, but an interesting wrinkle on an old idea down in Delaware. Mm-hmm. All right. Story number three. Heading into tonight's Monday night game against the Chargers, the Eagles are struggling. They've lost two straight. There's a lot of angst, capital A, angst. But everything's about to turn around, Cherry.
Oh, it is.
It is.
And why, pray tell, Avi Wolfman Arendt? What's the secret sauce?
The secret sauce is something called the Vibes Bunny.
Ooh.
Or perhaps the Positivity Bunny. It's been named multiple things.
Mm-hmm.
Backup running back A.J. Dillon purchased a large inflatable Easter bunny and stuck it in the middle of the Eagles locker room to try to instill some positivity back in the squad. This is the Vibes Bunny.
Bam.
And it made us think whether these types of gimmicks could actually improve office culture. I kind of sensed that, you know, our team was a little down today.
Yeah.
The meeting room was too cold.
Everybody, you know,
it's a long winter weekend. You're back in the office on Monday. Like, if we had a inflatable bunny, do you think our morning meeting would have gone better?
Well, maybe, yes.
Yeah, I think so.
You know what? I thought about the different animals and I was like, you know what? Bunnies always make me smile.
So that you think that's the most positive vibes animal?
And I do think it's a good vibes animal. And if you're on a sports team, it's the safest pick because you don't want to pick a mascot.
No one's the bunnies.
Yeah, you don't want to pick a dolphin. You know what I mean?
That's another team.
It's another team. So you can't. So bunnies, and they're fuzzy. And what has a bunny ever done, you know, to anybody?
I agree. Well, Bugs Bunny, he used to pull some pranks every once in a while. He was a mischievous bunny.
Wabbit.
Yeah.
You wascally wabbit.
I will say, I do think the bunny's a pretty good pick.
Yeah.
You could. I.
What else would you pick, though?
A wallaby. Positivity wallaby. I like that has a ring to it. For whatever reason, when I heard this story initially, I just imagined like two 55-year-old men on sports talk radio screaming at each other about what's the most positive bunny. You know, like a caller and a host.
Yeah.
Like it felt like a classic sports argument to
me. And what was interesting to me is that this bunny had Happy Easter on it. So he probably got it on super discount because it's Christmas.
Or he's had it in his attic. AJ Dillon, can you call into the show and tell us where you got the positivity bunny?
I love it.
No, but I do like that idea. And I do think the bunny's a pretty decent pick. But I think, you know, the obvious pick would be an eagle.
Yeah. But,
like,
you know,
like a positive
people are
eagle.
Mad at the Eagles right now.
They are. It's crazy and how fast things turn.
And I was like, y'all, because I was walking around. We have some Eagles fans, of course, in the office. And they had no words. They were just like really mad. Yeah, so yeah. I think seeing an Eagle, they might kick it.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, you're wearing green today. So clearly you're supporting the cause. Hey, that must have been the reason always. Why you're wearing. Anyways.
Go Birds.
Go Birds indeed. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show. It's going to be a serious topic. It's an interesting topic. There's a lot to learn about this topic. And the topic is AI. Mm-hmm. And surveillance/safety. There's a lot of AI integrated into various safety tools today. And the question we have for you is, would you trade privacy for a sense of safety when it comes to AI surveillance? Does AI and surveillance make you feel safer? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. How you doing? Drop a comment in the chat. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cameras are everywhere. Mm. They're in our pockets. They're posted on our door frames. And frankly, a lot of us are pretty darn used to it at this point. But how that video is being used and analyzed is starting to change with the rise of artificial intelligence.
AI surveillance tools are also being used by law enforcement in the form of gun spotting systems, license plate readers, and even facial recognition. It all happens without you noticing you've been spied on, and it happens several times a day. So today, we're talking about the risks and promises of AI and security.
With us to discuss the topic are Todd Feathers, contributor at Wired, covering algorithms, surveillance, and technology. Todd, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And Cade Crockford, Director of Technology and Justice Programs at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Cade, thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Good morning.
Yes. And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our questions of the day are this: would you trade privacy for a sense of safety? And does AI and surveillance make you feel safer? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat.
And as we start the show, we just wanted to mention that we reached out to a couple of companies that deploy this type of technology, one called Zero Eyes, one called OmniAlert. Neither of them were willing to provide a representative to appear on the show today, but we did want to note that at least before we begin the conversation.
And so, Todd, we wanted to kind of start with you because I think people have a general understanding of AI and how it connects with surveillance. We talked about facial recognition. We talk about license plate scanners. But I want you to kind of zoom out and really kind of give us an overview of the types of AI technology used in surveillance that folks might not ordinarily know about.
Yeah, this is a huge category. And I think one thing that's important to say is that, you know, even though I cover this, write about this, I don't have a great grasp on all the ways that AI is used in surveillance, and that algorithms are integrated into other systems around us, collect information on us, and then spit out predictions about us that are then used by government. But as you mentioned, you know, some of the ones that grab a lot of headlines are facial recognition technology, which, you know, looks at images or videos of people and matches them to other images of them in order to verify their identity. Automated license plate readers, you might see cameras all over your city, and many of these are connected to AI systems that read the license plates on cars and track vehicle movements throughout a city, a region, or in some systems, you know, the entire country. Some other things that folks might not be aware of are the vast amounts of data that are collected by private companies, but that can then be packaged and sold in various forms to law enforcement. That can parse through these things with algorithms in order to make predictions, you know, about areas where crimes will occur or who might commit a crime. And I think that one other big category that I want to mention is gunshot detection technology and weapon detection technology. The first is, you know, audio sensors that may be spread throughout a city that notify police when they believe that a gunshot has occurred. the second weapon detection technology is usually installed at the entrance to buildings. Comes in a number of different forms, but generally use AI algorithms to scan a person's body and see if it can detect any sort of weapon.
Interesting, yeah.
When you try to, I guess, essentialize about how AI is being used in the safety space, would it be fair to say, look, there are areas, there's this vast trove of data. It might be visual data, it might be numeric data. And what AI is generally being used to do is, sift through that data and make some sort of prediction. Is that the main way AI is being used? Sort of does that qualitative description make sense, or is it just a fraction of sort of the use cases here?
I think that that's a pretty good description. The AI is, in many ways, not a helpful term because it covers such a broad range of technology and algorithm. But when it comes to surveillance, yeah, I like that. I mean, AI is about pattern matching, finding patterns in big data sets, whatever that might be, and then as best as possible using math to predict, what the next iteration of that pattern is, or whether the next thing coming through the door will fit that pattern or not.
Quick follow-up question before we bring Kate into the conversation, Todd, is, we've I wonder, is it's used to sort of help make cities safer? And I think about red light cameras and, speed camera technology used in Philadelphia, where we've seen, sharp decreases in speeding along very dangerous highways. Can you just have there been positive results that you've seen that you've reported on in use of some of this technology?
Yes, there are. I'll just use gunshot detection technology as an example. There are certainly instances where gunshot detection systems have detected a gunshot, sent an alert to police, and maybe paramedics have come to the scene and saved a gunshot victim. I think that that is, a great outcome. However, I think well, something you said in your question to listeners at the beginning, I thought was really important and well said, which is, would you trade your privacy for a sense of safety? And I think that's the important thing, is the sense of safety versus actual hard data that proves, a city or a community is safer. And I think we see a lot of anecdotes which can contribute to a sense of safety for a lot of these systems. I would certainly like to see more independent, quantitative analysis of whether they're actually making people safer.
All right, Kate, I want to bring you in the conversation now. Kate Crockford, Director of the Technology for Liberty Program at the ACLU of Massachusetts. What are you tracking? What types of technology is on your radar right now? And what do you see as some of the potential downsides of this technology?
Sure, thanks for having me. So, yeah, we at the ACLU of Massachusetts and our colleagues nationwide and ACLU affiliates across the country, as well as the national ACLU, have been tracking machine learning technologies, image classification technologies, predictive policing systems that law enforcement have been using for some years now, including probably most prominently facial recognition. So we here in Massachusetts launched a campaign back in 2019 with the goal of passing local laws across Massachusetts to prevent police from using facial recognition technology, as well as passing state legislation at the Massachusetts legislature to essentially force police to adopt some checks and balances and some rules of the road with respect to the use of facial recognition. And I think, face surveillance is a really good example of why machine learning technologies, AI, advanced technologies can be so dangerous with respect to civil rights and civil liberties. So, for example, in a city like Philadelphia, where I just read this morning, there are 7,000 surveillance cameras in Philly's public surveillance camera network run by the police department. And I'm not even sure if that includes SEPTA cameras or not. There may be additional cameras as well as a part of the public transit system there. If the police were to overlay that public surveillance camera network with facial surveillance technology, it would facilitate a kind of surveillance that would enable the government to track a person from the moment they leave their house in the morning until the moment they return at night. And not just one person, but every person, and merely with the click of a button. And that is just completely different from anything that we've ever seen in this country or in the world, frankly, with respect to how it changes the balance of power between the government and the population, and specifically between the police and the people who are policed. And I want to say something very specific about that, which is that one of the things that we like as civil libertarians is friction between police investigations and members of the public. That doesn't mean that we don't want the police to be able to investigate serious crimes. It means, however, that, for example, law enforcement officials historically could not follow every person in Philadelphia around and take notes about who they were meeting with and what they were doing, because that's simply too expensive for the police department. You don't have that many cops, you don't have that many undercover officers. And so there's natural friction that limits Philly undercover officers to only following around people who are suspected of some really bad stuff, right? That's good. That's good for privacy. That's good for civil society. That's a healthy dynamic. Technology like facial recognition, when it's paired with a video surveillance network like the one that exists in Philly, completely erases that natural desired friction and enables the government to track all of us
So,
everywhere we
how would
go.
that work though? So, when you say track everyone all at once, like you're saying it's keeping a running log of, it could keep a running log of everyone's movements that could be referenced later. It could say,
That's a, yeah.
Avi went to work today, Avi went home, if someone queried it.
That's exactly right. So
Is it doing that anywhere?
historically,
It's not doing that in Philadelphia. Let's
Just
just
be
be
clear.
it's not
Is
doing that
it
in Philadelphia. I
is
want to
it
be clear.
is it
Yes,
doing
it
that
could.
anywhere?
In China, in
In China.
Russia, right? It's not clear to me that that's happening anywhere in the United States, although maybe the NYPD is doing it. They're very secretive about their surveillance in New York City, so it's not clear that they're doing that, but I think they very well could be. But to answer your question, why is that so dangerous? Why is that different from what we've seen historically? It's because, if you basically, like, historically, video surveillance systems were creating records that didn't serve very useful a purpose until there was some sort of incident that prompted the police to go back and look at a specific camera at a specific date and a specific time. And that's for the simple reason that it's not effective to have people watching 7,000 video camera feeds all day, right? They'd essentially stop seeing anything at a certain point. But artificial intelligence, machine learning, vision technologies enable the government and private actors, frankly, to turn all of that stored video data into a searchable archive so that you could search it by a person's face. You could search it by, the clothing that a person is wearing, the type of vehicle they're driving, whether they're on a bike, whether they're carrying a certain kind of shaped object. So that just totally transforms the purpose of surveillance cameras, which historically were really to allow police to look back to see if they captured a car crash or a robbery or a shooting, and now enabling a sort of persistent mass surveillance of every person's public movements and habits and associations, which I think probably all of your listeners can tell is really dangerous in a democratic society for obvious reasons.
Yeah, by the way, Melinda on Facebook says, no, it doesn't make me feel safer. It makes me feel more exposed. I don't like the new tech stuff. And by the way, our questions of the day for you, our listeners, are this: would you trade privacy for a sense of safety? Does AI and surveillance make you feel safer? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop comments in the chat. And by the way, I just want to make clear that Philadelphia does not employ facial recognition software generally across the city, but police may use it in specific investigations. So just to be clear about that point. And so I want to follow up with you, Kate. Are there uses of AI technology that you think do not cross the line? Because we're talking about right now, you're talking about, use of facial recognition software on a wide scale that's not happening necessarily in the United States. But are there uses that you would say do fall within the scope of the law and and are, you know, and don't necessarily trample on civil liberties?
Yeah, I think that there are certain use cases in various areas of government where government agencies, including the police, can make use of new technologies, including AI or machine learning technologies, as long as there is tight regulation in the law and there are reasonable checks and balances and accountability measures and oversight measures to ensure that those laws are being followed. So one example of that is, I think, sort of related to what you just referenced about what the Philly police are doing. Here in Massachusetts, our campaign on facial recognition doesn't say the police can never use facial recognition technology. It distinguishes between what I described before, this China-style, Russia-style use of AI to analyze video data, this mass surveillance function, effectively, and prohibits that and enables the police to use facial recognition image analysis technology when they have a picture, for example, even if it comes from a surveillance camera, but it's selected by a human being of someone committing a crime, you know, doing a kidnapping or something like that. We don't object to police taking that image, going to a judge, getting a warrant, and then performing a facial recognition search to try to put a name to that face, right? That's a totally different application of facial recognition technology than simply, you know, using AI to keep tabs on what everybody's doing constantly all the time throughout a city.
Skybomb MC on YouTube says, sadly, I do not trust AI and security because I don't know what guardrails exist to prevent persecution of someone that is innocent. I wanted to shift the conversation to maybe a more limited use of this type of surveillance. So I would imagine if you ask most Americans, they would agree with Cade that they don't want this everywhere all the time. But there are certain sensitive spaces, schools, hospitals, campuses, where people's opinion might change a little bit, that they might be okay with a machine looking for abnormalities, which is, I think, essentially what the AI is doing, looking for weird patterns that a human might want to check up on. So, Todd, can you first tell us a little bit about how this technology is or is not being used in some of these more security-sensitive areas and what some of like the pros and cons are of that type of use?
Yeah, well, if I can zoom in on schools, because that's the area that I write about the most, and I think it is really illustrative of what's going on in the broader surveillance world right now, because, I mean, there is a nationwide crisis of guns, you know, and shootings in schools right now. There is a lot of reasons for parents to be concerned about, you know, children, their children, other people's children bringing weapons to schools. And the vendors that are selling products to school districts and police departments know about this and are really taking advantage of it to sell some tools that you know, I think probably work pretty well and are well thought out and have taken into account, you know, student and school leader voices. But there's a lot that haven't also. And I think to some degree, understandably, you know, school leaders have been, you know, pretty willing to just experiment with these tools, to bring them into their buildings and say, you know, we're going to install a weapons detection system here. It may generate some amount of false positives, you know, instances where it says that there is a weapon on a person and there isn't, but that's worth it for, you know, the one time that it detects a real weapon walking into that school.
And that's mostly what these are being used for in school, basically surveilling the entire campus to see, does someone have a weapon, and then alerting a human so that they can then follow up on that, you know, digital tip. But that's the basic use right now.
For the weapons detection technology, sure.
Yeah.
You know, that there are some schools, this is more in higher education, but some school districts as well, that will monitor, you know, student social media use and run that through algorithms that may predict, you know, is a student at risk of, you know, harming themselves or others. Actually, in public schools, you know, many students in districts, everything they do on their school-issued laptop is surveilled and monitored by AI and can be flagged for indications of, you know, suicidal behavior or violent behavior. And, you know, I've looked at these filters, other journalists have looked at these filters, and they are not perfectly accurate.
Yeah, that was going to be the
So,
follow-up question
yeah.
there. So how accurate are they?
Accuracy is is the question when it comes to surveillance, and I spend a lot of my time just trying to figure out what accuracy means for any given technology and how to get information about it. I am chronically disappointed in the lack of information that's made available to us as citizens about the accuracy and reliability of surveillance products that are put into place by our government. I wrote for years about gunshot detection systems trying to get, accuracy numbers for some of the most prominent ones out there. A company called SoundThinking, formerly called ShotSpotter, claims that its system is 97% accurate, that it 97% of the time it correctly identifies gunshots. Through a lot of reporting by myself and others, some really good work by, local governments and advocacy groups, numbers have now started to come out, and it varies by vendor and city where, the accuracy ratings, depending on how you measure it, are as low as 8-9% for these things. And I think that in order to have an honest public debate about whether these tools are making us safer, we really need to be doing better, sharing information about the accuracy of these systems and what we mean by that.
Dry Molasses on YouTube says, I was surprised at the facial recognition software Citizens Bank Park had for a concert. Citizens Bank Park is the major baseball stadium here in Philadelphia. It flagged me for extra screening. I think it should have been a bigger piece of info when I bought the tickets. Dry Molasses hoping that that would have been disclosed in some way. One of my biggest points of confusion with this whole conversation, Cade, is just how good this technology is. Not how good it could be or how much better it is than the past, but how good it is right now. Because on the one hand, I hear, statements about how this facial recognition technology is turning us or could turn us into an all-consuming surveillance state. On the other hand, I read articles about how this stuff is basically snake oil and that people are taking advantage of unsuspecting school administrators to sell technology that doesn't even really work. Help me parse that because I almost feel like those two things, it's very hard for me to imagine those two things coexisting. The sort of incredibly effective and it's everywhere surveillance versus, yeah, this is just packaged crap to win a contract from a school district.
It's a great question. And the answer is face surveillance technology is dangerous when it works and when it doesn't, frankly, for different reasons, right? And the reality is that, like every other type of product, you can buy a crappy pair of shoes. You can also buy a really nice pair of shoes that last 25 years, right? Facial recognition technologies are no different. Back in 2019, there was a study that the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which is a nonpartisan government research and testing organization, did. They examined about 200 face recognition algorithms made and sold by a variety of companies across the country and across the world. And they found really pretty wide variance in terms of how accurately those technologies classify the faces of people of different ethnic and racial backgrounds, ages, and genders. And that's pretty consistent with other studies looking at facial recognition algorithms. There's a test that NIST does called the facial recognition vendor test. And again, if you look at those, they're sort of difficult to parse, but there's been media reporting about them over the years. And the companies perform really differently across the board in terms of accuracy generally, and in terms of accuracy across different racial and ethnic and age and gender groups. So, the answer is it depends, right? It depends on the quality of the technology that the company is selling. But I think, for me, the question about should we be using technology like face surveillance in schools or gun detection systems or things like that is really a sort of a way that the industry is taking advantage, and this is a very large industry. It's like worth billions of dollars a year. This industry is taking advantage of the legitimate fear that parents and school communities and superintendents and principals have about guns in this country, and using that fear to take taxpayer dollars to provide technologies that will not stop school shootings, period. They won't. They will not stop school shootings. Here's an example of that.
We'll get to that on the other side of this break. Okay. We do have to break now. That's Kate Crockford. We're also talking with Todd Feathers. We'll hear more from them the other side of this break about this technology, its effectiveness, its uses, and what perhaps some rules of the road could look like. Keep those calls and comments coming. Studio 2 at WHYY.org, 888-477-9499.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman, Aaron. We're talking this hour about AI and surveillance, whether it's making people safer. Let me reintroduce our guests. With us are Todd Feathers, contributor at Wired, covering algorithms, surveillance, and technology. We also have Cade Crockford, director of technology and justice programs at the ACLU of Massachusetts.
Yes, and we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere. Would you trade privacy for a sense of safety? And does AI and surveillance make you feel safer? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop your comments in the chat.
So Matt, one of our commenters, is a little critical of our show today, mm-hmm. saying that, you know, we're tilting this conversation by describing this as spying, that, you know, that a lot of law enforcement organizations might give us a very different perspective if we heard from them about the effectiveness or the helpfulness of these tools. And I guess that leads me to a question, Kate, of like what the reasonable alternative is here, because let's just talk about video surveillance. Video surveillance is a reality of life because of cell phones, because of Ring doorbells, because of, publicly posted cameras by law enforcement agencies. And if we have this video everywhere, is it not better to have some machine sifting through it to look for what's valuable in there versus just letting, you know, extremely fallible human beings in a control center somewhere make their own calls about who looks suspicious and what needs to be interrogated?
Well, I think we have to think about the purpose of government, right? And what the role that we actually want the police to serve in our society, as well as, you know, what are actually effective anti-crime and anti-violence measures that our society can take. There have been studies showing that increased Medicaid benefits that were provided in the post-COVID period have reduced crime rates across the country. There are other studies that show that there's a direct relationship between the number of nonprofit organizations in a community and the violent crime rate, right? Obviously, a family's, a community's access to mental health care, to the essentials of human life, food, education, affordable housing, are huge determinants in terms of whether crime spikes or it doesn't. So, you know, that's the first comment that I would make, is that if we are concerned about crime, and I think, you know, many of us are, depending on where we live in the country, there are measures that our society can take to address the root causes of violence and crime that don't involve policing at all and don't involve surveillance. So that would be my first response. Second, though, I would ask people to look at, for example, a data point that has existed for many years in policing, which is how often police are closing murder investigations, meaning, you know, how often they're actually solving serious crimes. And what's interesting is that those numbers haven't changed a whole lot, despite the rapid acceleration of, you know, technology adoption in government and policing across the country.
And I'll push back on you a little bit, Kay, because just last week we had the head of our homicide division on, and they actually have had the highest clearance rate when it comes to homicides in about 40 years. And I won't say that, you know, artificial intelligence was totally part of this, but they've had an increase in technology and that has allowed them to solve cases a lot faster. So I wanted to sort of ask you that counterpoint, because just more cameras mean that we were told that, you know, that type of data doesn't go away. You don't like witnesses, and witnesses, faulty information for witnesses led to wrongful convictions. So just any response to, you know, the fact that speed of solving these cases has increased, specifically in Philadelphia, as well as, you know, the fact that this type of data just hangs around a lot longer than, you know, witness data.
Absolutely. And, you know, I wasn't familiar with that data from Philly, and that's great to hear that the clearance rates are up in Philadelphia. My understanding is that across the country, that pattern has not held, that, mm-hmm. you know, as we've seen more technology adoption in law enforcement, the homicide clearance rates have not increased in the same in the way that you might expect. That's certainly the case here in Boston, where they have essentially remained stagnant over many years, and in some years actually decreased, despite the fact that, you know, we have more and more surveillance. But I think, you know, your question is a good one. I'm interested in studies like one that was conducted by the government in England, a country where London is one of the most heavily surveilled cities on earth. And they wanted to know, is there a relationship between the public investment in surveillance cameras and, you know, solving serious crimes, essentially. And what the government there found was that for every 1,000 cameras in London, police were solving about one crime per year. And I think that's not a great cost benefit, frankly, you know, given how invasive surveillance is, mm-hmm. and particularly in the AI age, how invasive it can be when those technologies are applied to video surveillance data. That's not a great return on investment for taxpayers in England. And so, you know, I think there can be more done. There may be differences in terms of how different cities approach technology usage and how they pair it with other ways of investigating crimes. But again, you know, I think if we really are concerned about crime in our society, we ought to look at government programs that address the root causes of crime, which tend to work much better and frankly also keep people alive. I mean, I think all of us can agree that we would rather people not be murdered in the first place than, you know, continue to just sort of focus on only law enforcement investments as a means of addressing crime, which usually address crime after it's taken place.
We actually have a caller, Amy from Barnegat Light, who I think has a comment about how this technology is used in London. So, Amy, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear your question or comment.
It's sort of, you know what, she just sort of answered what I was saying before. I didn't know about the fact that there was one crime solved per 1,000 surveillance cameras, which does change how it feels when you find out that London has got the highest rate of surveillance. But the thing is, it is still a very heavily surveilled area, and I think we could use a little information from them and see what it is that they're doing. It's not just China and Russia, in other words.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The problem is who's going to be using it in our country, unfortunately, is not who's using it in Great Britain.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the big problem right now.
And I also want to point out, thanks for that call, Amy, that we've had a lot mm-hmm. of people who've written in about how AI is used to collect tolls, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, automatic toll readers. I think this goes to license plate readers. I'm curious, Todd, what's emerging in that front? And, you know, Cade talked before about friction. We want a certain amount of friction when it comes to surveillance and investigation. But this is an area where I think people might desire less friction. And as someone who used to wait in long toll lines, I certainly see the benefits of being able to, you know, collect tolls really, really quickly. But some of our commenters are worried about accuracy. What do we know about sort of that? I mean, it's weird to call that surveillance, but it's a form of surveillance. Mm-hmm. What do we know about that type of deployment of AI technology? Oh, I think you're muted, Todd.
My apologies. The systems that we have at Toll Boost that read your license plate and record that and, you know, automatically bill you sometime later are, you know, kind of on a base technological level, the same as automated license plate readers that the police and federal agencies use. And so, you know, I would describe myself as generally a privacy conscious and surveillance skeptic person, but, you know, I don't have a problem with a camera collecting my license plate when I go through a toll booth. What would concern me is what happens after that. Does, you know, the information that I've traveled through that toll booth get stored for the rest of my life? Does it get fed into another database and tied into other data about my movements to track my locations? And how long does that information get kept? So I think it's really important when talking about AI and technology to remember that like the technology is actually not that big of a piece of this. It's really the people and how we implement it and what safeguards we put in place that to me is so much more important than whether the next algorithm is slightly more accurate.
To that point, Todd, we've read a lot recently about Palantir and other companies who contract with the federal government. And my understanding of that type of technology, and it is deploying AI on some level, but it's using AI to search through humongous databases, maybe a whole array of databases, triangulate some information about people, and then sort of pick out potential, you know, targets of ICE enforcement or other types of government action. And, you know, that's not, I guess, maybe as eye-catching a use of AI because it doesn't, you know, look like something, you know, Minority Report or something like that. But I wonder how prevalent that is, the use of AI just to, trawl through humongous databases and then kind of figure out what type of digital breadcrumbs an individual has left behind. Is that super prevalent, emerging? Where is that technology?
It's ubiquitous. Every time you open a social media app, you know, if you're watching on YouTube, there are algorithms running on YouTube that are tracking every single thing you do on that website, from how long you hover over something before clicking on it, to how far down the page you scroll, how long you spend watching a video. And all of that is being used to predict your future behaviors and in the commercial space to sell you things. We know that this is happening to some degree, in governments. The Associated Press a few weeks ago just had a really important story about Customs and Border, I always get the acronym wrong, is it Protection or Patrol? CBP.
Yep.
Has been, using algorithms to parse nationwide license plate reader data to predict drivers that are suspicious and pull them over on other pretenses and participation with local law enforcement. We know that, spy agencies to some degree are buying commercial data from data brokers, doing pattern matching on it to surveil at some capacity people around the world, possibly American citizens. But it is scary how little we know about government pattern matching.
Yeah, I want to bring it. Kate, if you want to go right ahead, finish your thought.
I just wanted to offer some sort of a zoomed out thought about this idea of privacy versus safety and technology and surveillance's role. The technologies that actually provide us safety are things like door locks and curtains and fences, things that actually have nothing to do with technology and cannot be hacked and cannot be used against the people who are putting them up for security purposes. Whereas these other technologies can actually harm us. So not just in the context of, ICE getting access to license plate reader data that's collected by our local police department and the Trump administration using that to hurt people in our community, although that is a huge concern. Yeah. There's also been reporting about Flock, which is one of these license plate reader companies, having really, frankly, bad security practices in terms of, keeping... making sure that their own credentials for logging in to access Flock accounts are not misused. There were reports that some Flock credentials were on sale on a Russian cybercrime website. So, the idea that blanketing our society in surveillance that is sold to us by private companies who are not answerable to the public or accountable to us through our elected democracy is going to bring us safety is sometimes the exact opposite of what's happening.
I'm gonna stop you, Kate, because I want to try to get this caller in before we ask you a final question. We only have 2.5 minutes left. Santiana from Philadelphia is on the line. Santiana, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment? And could you keep it brief because we're towards the end of the show?
Absolutely. So I just wanted to piggyback off of what the previous callers were remarking on. It's just the fact that, one, we have kind of elected to our society and surveillance products like Ring, kind of proactively, people have all of these surveillance products that they have opted into that end up sometimes in the hands of police or, any type of government agency. And so I was wanting to comment on the fact that our Fourth Amendment is made to protect us from, you know, unlawful search and seizures, but the law has not really been able to keep up with our technological advances. And so I do think we probably need to rethink how we can provide some type of constitutional or protection for our privacy rights, given the fact that commercial companies not only collect so much data about us, but also, like you all are mentioning, public agencies do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Santi. And I'm going to have to end it right there just because lack of time. And I wanted to close this out by sort of talking about, you know, the federal government is not really going to be able to keep up with the fast moving technology. And if each of you could say, like, if you were a local government, local agency, like what would be a guardrail that you would want to see put up? And if each of you could take like 30 seconds and answer that, Todd, we'll start with you. 30 seconds, please.
Yeah, I'm not going to say a specific thing. I just want to say that there's actually really good work being done in this area. The city of San Jose has kind of led a nationwide effort of cities to create good practices around the use of AI in government. That's a good starting point. You know, look at what others have done. Cade, I know, has worked on some good policy issues. Yeah.
And Cade, 30 seconds.
There's stuff out there to copy. Yeah.
If you were to...
I would just say that, generally speaking, we need to reorient our public technology policy to put residents at the center, right? And that means different things in different communities. But in cities like Philly and Boston and New York, it means ensuring that there's democratic oversight of police surveillance technology acquisitions and the way that police use that technology, so that decisions about public surveillance and how police use surveillance and investigations are not made by police alone and are made in collaboration with the people who are being policed and who want to feel safe in their communities.
That was Cade Crockford, Director of Technology and Justice Programs at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Cade, thanks for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks to you as well, Todd Feathers, contributor at Wired, covering algorithms, surveillance, and technology. Todd, a pleasure.
Likewise.
And thanks to everybody who called and wrote in for today's show, giving your perspective. And thanks, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producers, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We'll talk to you tomorrow.